say, kids, what time is it?
The future is coming on, it's coming on, it's coming on, it's coming on, it's coming on.
And then today we're not coming in from Boulder Creek. No. We are at the beach house.
All new setup.
Crazy techies we are. We brought all our gear with us.
That's right. To create every a whole generation. New setup. Some of this gear is 20 years old. Some of this gear is 20 minutes old.
Yeah. And now we're going to take you, like Max Headroom, 20 minutes into the future.
That's right. And we've got some special guests here with us. We've got a full house.
You switch over to the 360 camera to see everybody.
I see. Yeah, right.
Since we're not live, we can do this.
Hi, Bobby. How's everything in San Francisco?
It's a sunny day. It's great. Yeah.
It's sunny in San Francisco? That's a twist.
Wow.
Yeah. It's a special show today. We have Randy Masters visiting. Randy Masters received his BA in Interrelations of Music and Film from UC Santa Cruz. One of the first Santa Cruz graduates, no doubt.
Yeah, early.
Yeah, early days.
Right? I started there in like 68. So.
Yeah, so you saw it when it first started.
Oh, it was fabulous.
Wow. Well, with Ralph Abraham and some
all other. The guys, they're all friends of mine in one way or another.
Wow. Yeah. Okay, well, that's a good topic right there.
Yeah.
He says you've done postgraduate studies in music, sacred geometry, probably not at UC Santa Cruz, geometry. Yeah.
No.
Acoustics and alternative healing methods.
Mm-hmm.
Like Reiki, like Rolfing. That sort of thing.
Well, right? all kinds of things like that.
Okay, you know? So we'll talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, sonic acupuncture. Yeah, I could.
Sonic.
Sonic acupuncture.
Sane
acupuncture.
You had a sonic screwdriver or something.
Oh, flathead or a Phillips.
Who had this?
You know, the Phillips screwdriver, milk of magnesia and vodka. Yeah, you know what I'm saying?
So you studied music with Roger Adams and Henry Mancini.
Well, my trumpet teacher and my first guitar teacher, he played both. He played with Henry Mancini and a lot of famous people, Frank Sinatra. He was a lead high note trumpet player, virtuoso.
Oh.
So I took lessons from him in high school. In fact, I played the last gig because he had a heart attack. And so they hired me to play the gig, which was an honor, but I mean, it was just kind of a sad occasion.
Yeah, yeah, but that's sometimes how that things shift.
Yeah, but he was incredible. I had a good time with all of that.
Huh.
Yeah, and I became a professional musician starting in my freshman year in high school.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was real big fun.
Uh-huh.
All my other degree stuff came elsewhere. You know, my master's and PhD are in divinity, so that's a little different.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, that's I'm looking forward
Dr.
to
Future
hearing
and
about that journey.
Dr. Music. I don't know what to say.
Well, there's an interesting shift in your life where I'm kind of curious about where you became quite successful as a jazz musician and working with some of the greats and traveling. Were you like doing gigs, traveling around the country? A little bit.
I wasn't big on traveling because I was mostly teaching. I started teaching in my senior year at the university. I started teaching at the university.
Like a graduate student?
Yeah, kind of like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was teaching jazz music courses and things.
In UC Santa Cruz?
Yeah, I actually created the courses. Oh. And then I taught there for 9 more years with a whole jazz program that I personally created and ran myself.
Yeah. Well, that's what I heard about the early university, is that it was a pretty much, you were creating the curriculum.
Like absolutely.
The whole idea of what education was for the kids.
Oh, yeah, it was really fun.
Yeah.
Totally fun. Then I went to San Jose State after that, which was good for me in a lot of ways, but it didn't have the environment and
the freedom of that.
Oh, UC Santa Cruz in those early days. There was no other campus like that.
Oh.
They had a graduate program called the History of Consciousness.
Oh.
I almost went for that for graduate work.
Wow.
But things evolved. You know, next thing you know, I'm teaching and I don't want to enroll in anything now. Yeah. You know. But it had a big impact on me when I went there taking philosophy classes. It's all part of how I developed, not just in the music study. And then I got into film because I wanted to write soundtracks for movies. because I started writing music in high school, and a lot of the things I wrote were for an imaginary movie in my mind.
Right, right.
But later on, some of those pieces got used in actual soundtracks that I did.
Which fantastic.
Was, I paid it forward, you know, that was a...
Yeah, that's big for being a musician, actually get stuff and...
Yeah, but I didn't want to go to L.A. and be involved with the scene there, or the obscene there.
Well, if you were exposed to UC Santa Cruz early, you had a high standard for where you wanted to go. Right?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
I wonder, Ralph Abraham, I think, where I first learned about cymatics from...
Oh, you learned from him, yeah.
Yeah, because he was really into it from...
Well, he was an amazing mathematician.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally.
In my mind, at least, I've seen both you and him connect.
And he studied a lot of Indian music from the Batish family, Ashwin and his father, Shiv Dayal Batish. Mm-hmm. So he was a good friend with them. And I was with Ashwin Batish, too, and studied and played. We had a band called Sitar Power for a while, Indo jazz rock fusion group, playing interesting versions of ragas.
Huh?
Wow.
That was one of the eclectic groups.
Yeah.
And Ashwin played concerts with me and my international band that I had musicians from different countries. Wow. That's been kind of my thing, you know.
Right.
Not really leading the bebop life. I played that.
Uh-huh.
You have to. You know, you want to be a jazz musician, you got to be able to do the bebop scene.
Uh-huh.
But my soul was not a bebop musician.
Huh?
You know.
Well, so yeah, I'm curious about the connection between your journey to divinity school and your international musical development.
Yeah.
And are they related?
And you're traveling? Did you start traveling?
Limited traveling, not living out on the road and sleeping in sheet flip motels or something. You know what I'm saying?
Stuff
that a lot of musicians have to deal with.
Well, you didn't have to go on the road.
Yeah, off the road, the motel. I mean, it probably was cleaner on the road, but anyway, that wasn't my deal.
Was there a particular an international musician that connected with you that made you feel like you wanted to get out and see more world music?
I thought that's where it was going to go. And I stopped teaching at San Jose State in 1989, and I thought the next thing was going to be, well, let me just dedicate my music to being on the road and recording.
Hmm.
And it just didn't quite flow that way, but I played with Hedjoli Sounds from Ghana for 15 years. They used to be with Hugh Masekela, the guy that wrote Grazing in the Grass. I don't know if you heard of him, a trumpet player from South Africa. Amazing.
Wow.
Connected up with Miriam Makeba, and he was in that whole big African music festival down in, you know, South Africa that happened.
Mm-hmm.
So they left Hugh, who was a trumpet flugelhorn player and a vocalist and an amazing performer. And when they met me, I could play everything that Hugh Masekela could play.
Really?
Just like him. I mean, I could, you know, channel him basically if I wanted to. But I mean, and so I fit right in. Plus I played keyboard. So they made me the music director of the group. They moved here for a while. And we started our first gig at the Catalyst playing. The old original Catalyst in Santa Cruz.
Oh, wow.
By the Hip Pocket bookstore way back in the day.
Yeah.
And the night, because most of the good gigs were at night, you know.
Yeah.
And then I set up a gig for them at UC Santa Cruz, because I was still on the scene with a lot of things, and they just adopted me. Mm-hmm. And I was the only non-African in the band. Yeah.
How'd that feel?
Great. You know, I mean, totally brotherhood. Maybe other lifetimes in Africa or somehow, you know, I just blended in.
Mm-hmm.
And I even sang vocal parts. I didn't know what I was saying. I did it all phonetically. I didn't know.
Yeah.
That was kind of fun.
Yeah.
But I sang more in that group not singing in English than I ever did in English.
Really?
And that was like a 15-year deal.
Wow.
So what happened is... So a lot of musicians that I had given my music to over the years, I'd go to Kuumba and other places, go backstage, meet them, give them music. It kind of fell through the cracks. Stuff didn't happen. So finally got, well, we'll create our own record company. Let's go ahead and record. So in 75, I put out my first album called Solar Plexus with my group. We created our own independent record company for a few albums. And that was really fun. Well, and all of a sudden I'm recording. See, I thought I would be writing. I was more focused on doing that.
So was it a friend of yours that was into recording that got you into that? Or you felt like...
Another musician friend of mine who just decided to create a record company. And next thing you know, we had a record company. Really, it was like fast, like all instant. You know, what do you do in Santa Cruz, you know?
Well, I guess it also serves as a social hub for musicians.
Oh, totally. Yeah, it was very nice. Yeah. So recorded in San Francisco at Blossom Studios up on 10th and Howard.
Nice studio?
Well,
socially?
No comment on that. It was nice enough to do an 8-track recording with multiple tracks, because then he didn't have 16, so we had to bounce things down and record, and that all worked out. And I had three of my African friends from the African group playing percussion on that, and so it was really an Afro-Latin album. I wrote all the music, but there was no swing tunes, you know, not that kind of ballads or any of that type of thing. And that was my deal. Yeah. And then I always played in Santa Cruz. When I played my own music, it was all international stuff.
Hmm. Well, what kind of audience did you find was attracted to that?
Well, the jazz audiences that liked salsa and like Cuban music and Brazilian music. I started in high school, my first compositions were Brazilian.
Wow.
Because we had an exchange student from Brazil that played the Brazilian piano. In my freshman year in high school, I go, ooh, and I started hearing the Jobim's music and others, and I took right to it, you know, and then started writing that kind of music without any training in composition. So, there's a whole story of wherever that background came from.
Yeah.
But I don't have to go back and rewrite any of that music. It was pro right out of the gate.
Wow.
Like I was supposed to do it. This was my timing, and away I went. And then I got into other type of things, salsa and that, and eventually sat in and played as a featured guest with Tito Puente and his Latin Jazz All-Stars. He was, you know, the king of salsa from New York, the timbale player, arranger. And he invited me to join the band. Mm. But there were some things in the social scene that wasn't really right for me. To be on the road. They played like 300 one-night stands a year. Can you imagine? All over the world.
Wow, 300?
Yeah.
That's like
almost every day somewhere. The bus, the sound check at the hotel, the sound check at the bus, plane.
I hear you. I'm more like you. I like to have a home, you know.
Yeah. I was more like that, you know. Yeah. But I loved the band, and I could play fluent salsa like a Cuban trumpet player. I studied that. Yeah. Like I did a lot of things where it's almost like channeling it, you know.
Well, that's what I was wondering, because there's creativity and there's your own being in the groove, and then there's picking up information, you know, from the universe, from some kind of trance.
Yeah, and the idioms and the patterns.
Yeah.
So the thing that was constant was pattern recognition, which I took into sacred geometry, be able to see patterns, hear patterns, compose and understand patterns, play patterns. Huh. So what are the patterns that a Cuban trumpet player would play, or piano? I played that style too.
A pattern would be like a rhythm or
a riff.
A riff?
Or a melody, a lick, a rhythmic pattern.
Anything that repeats.
Pretty much, yeah. And I'd see those idioms, and then I'd incorporate those in the playing. So I sounded like I had lived in Cuba.
So you'd remember the patterns right away.
Uh-huh. And my family almost moved to Cuba back in the early 50s. My uncle worked with Lucky Luciano. They were partners in building like the Sands Hotel and the Thunderbird and the El Cortez. Those were his.
Las Vegas?
Yeah, his. Yeah, uh-huh. Uh-huh. Marion Hicks.
Yeah. She's a Las Vegas girl, by the way. She's
So did you know them through Cuba? Is there a Cuban connection?
So what happened is they had meetings down there with the mafias and the people. Because they wanted to set up a Las Vegas in Cuba.
Ah, right.
So it had a good start with a few hotels in Cuba already. But they got wind of Castro coming.
Yeah.
And I go, we're not going to really be able to run the show here. That's my understanding. Because, they're not going to be able to power over Castro leading everything.
Yeah.
So they put the kibosh on that. But for a number of years, that's what they were planning to do. You know,
they didn't want to deal with that.
No, right.
Easier to
interfered
deal
with their plan and controls, you know.
Yeah.
But they started all this stuff by taking ocean-going liners and sailing out past the 3-mile international water limit.
Oh.
And they had a floating Las Vegas out there, and they'd sail out of Long Beach.
Oh, interesting.
And then they decided to create an on-land version, and they chose Las Vegas, which at that time had one club, the Sons of the Pioneer Club, I think it was.
Uh-huh.
One club and a brothel that the sheriff owned. I mean, that's, you know, there are certain things that have to be part of the groundwork. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. And as a jazz musician, you have an inside view. Yeah,
I do, you know. But fortunately, I left there and I didn't get corrupted by that. But it is a very colorful background.
Yeah.
You can read about it in the Greenfelt Jungle book or the other book behind the G-string. That's another one. Those are two famous books about early. I mean, that's an interesting title.
Yeah,
you know,
behind the G-string.
Yeah, so whatever my fan, but I did have a girlfriend at one time who was a dancer at Bally's in Las Vegas.
One of the American dreams.
Yeah, I could have. Yeah, right.
You know,
playing trumpet in a big band or something.
I could have been Las playing. Vegas. Yeah, so yeah. Elvis did Vegas.
Backing up, you know, Frank Sinatra or somebody else. You know,
right. Yeah. But that wasn't quite the end of the for you. That was almost like the beginning of your.
Things would happen to me throughout my music career. Were just about the time I think some record company's going to sign me, and I even know the president. Stuff drops through the cracks. It doesn't happen. Spirit was making sure I didn't do when I got to certain forks in the road that I didn't take them. So I'd look down, and there'd be a tuning fork, and I'd pick it up, and I'd look at the frequency. See, that's what happened when I got to the fork in the road. That was
a tuning fork.
Well, you know, I mean, that's part of my career.
You make tuning forks, right? And that's how it started. How did it start?
Well, I had dreams, and I would get tuning forks. My higher self and guys would kept giving me tuning forks. And I was very interested in how sound works.
Yeah.
And the deeper part of composition that you don't typically learn in school about studying the famous musicians. They don't go into certain things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I learned that after. And then I wonder, you were asking about how good education be. All these things I didn't learn that I'm relearning now or just learning now that I didn't get then.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of mind-blowing, you know, the stuff they fed us.
Yeah, there's a lot of holes in the knowledge, but now
I didn't gain any weight on that stuff. You know, not at all. It wasn't nutritious enough.
Not good enough,
And a lot of the music professors didn't really understand where I was coming from.
No.
Because I was I was advanced, but I was cool enough to not embarrass them in class or do anything like that. Because I was soaking it up, and I was on good behavior, you know, at that point. You see?
Sure, yeah. Was that when you started to get interested in how sound and healing might be connected?
Yeah, and part of that happened because my freshman year in college, I was taking the philosophy classes. I even thought of being a philosophy major. So I had to deal with words and concepts, and I enjoyed that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a real lot.
I mean, what
and I kept playing and writing and having a band and doing that, but that fascinated me.
Yeah.
That led into metaphysics and into spirituality, not religions, although I did study a lot of stuff about the religions.
But philosophy was your gateway into all this.
Yeah, totally. And so it was very eclectic, you know, kind of a Renaissance lifetime, you might say.
Yeah. So was there a particular philosopher that you resonated with?
Wittgenstein was one. He was like super hip on words and things, and his philosophy, I really grasped it. And then, you know, when I got into film, taking classes in film journalism and film criticism, in some of my papers I remember, the graduate student couldn't handle it and thought I copied it out of something, so I had to take it to the instructor and say, look, I wrote this. It was detailed comments of everything, the cutting, the shadows, and what the shadow meant in this scene. I mean, I got into details. So I could have been a film journalist that wrote criticism or books about analyzing films at that time.
Did you get into watching movies?
Oh, yeah. Wait, totally. And going to the screenings that we had.
Really?
I mean, I totally enjoyed all that. But, you know, it was a little ahead of a lot of the students. So the guy thought I, you know, plagiarized something, and I didn't. I had to show them. And the instructor knew that, but the graduate student didn't.
Oh, yeah, that's
right.
It can be,
so
it can change your trajectory.
Right, a little bit.
Yeah.
But I enjoyed it.
Yeah.
And, you know, I majored in both and created my major to be called The Interrelations of Film and Music. independent major, because you could do stuff like that at UC Santa Cruz. Yes. Why? Because I didn't want any of the music department telling me what to do.
Hmm. Classic. Really.
I saw what was going on. I'm not going there. I'm more developed than that. And by combining the two, I could take all the film and all the music classes that I wanted, and I picked my own board, and none of them could tell me what to do. I kind of got hip to a few things.
Yeah, I'd say. But any real filmmaker knows that 50% of a film is the sound.
Yeah. I was always fascinated by that. Even a little kid, some of the first songs I played in music were the themes from movies. I'd always pay attention to the movie themes, how they were put together, who wrote them, you know, all the film composers.
Like the Pink Panther.
Or right, man. Yeah, exactly. Catchy stuff and fun.
Yeah.
You know, a lot better than a lot of films that have been done that didn't have really that kind of depth of melodies. And you know, you come out of a film and there's a theme and you're still humming the theme. You carry that theme maybe quite a ways in your life.
Yeah, yeah.
Because of the effect that it had.
Yes.
Some of the best music was coming out of movies. And
the story that was associated with that.
Yeah.
Theme. Yeah. Yeah.
And I thought I would one of the junctions in the road is I went to hear at UCLA Lalo Schifrin's Requiem for those who died in the Vietnam War. He wrote this Requiem and used the UCLA choir and orchestra, supplemented by Hollywood studio musicians. All right, so it was quite an orchestra. Wow. So I went down there and I wanted to meet him because he taught at USC and UCLA where he would teach film scoring. And I wanted to study with him privately. And I asked him, well, at that time he didn't have time. So I wasn't one of those guys to camp out on his land, his house, until he took me on as a student. I love things he wrote for all the different movies that he did.
So
the Fox,
movies did he work on?
And Mission Impossible, everybody knows, you know.
Yeah, really?
Because he was a jazz piano player. He used to play with Dizzy Gillespie. He's from Argentina.
Oh.
And he was fantastic at composing. Plus, he was a jazz musician. So I connected with all of that type of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And others. Yeah. And so that was my dream. So when I would write music, they give me an idea of something. I'd think up a movie scene and just write some music for it. You know?
You think up the scene and the music.
Yeah. I'd make up a scene in my mind, whatever it was.
Yeah.
And then I'd write music that would fit that kind of a scene.
That's cool. Yeah. So you have a complete...
Yeah, I had to make up something. It wasn't just, sitting around waiting for inspiration to strike. It didn't.
Right.
I sat down and conjured it up out of kind of nowhere. You know?
That's great. That's great. And it never came easy to you.
Yeah, pretty much. Huh. And the more I did it, the easier it got. And I still have all that music. And like I said, I don't have to go back and correct things because I didn't know certain things about music. And I wasn't writing at a kid level at all. I was young, but it was not at a kid level. So where did that come from? Well, I think past lives that some I'm aware of have been a composer in other lifetimes. But I keep that pretty quiet on. Where did that come from to get that training where I knew what to do without, I hadn't had any theory classes. They didn't have any in my high school at all, theory or harmony classes. I just took the band and that type of stuff.
Well, one of the prevailing theories is that our bodies are walking through an intelligent field. So that information is out there that you're just interacting with the antennas in your body.
Absolutely. I would agree.
You know, so,
but my antennas seem to be tuned to certain things.
Right, right. Everyone has their own unique sensibilities.
I'm picking up on that. Pretty funny. I remember one scene where my band opened up at the Del Mar Theater in Santa Cruz with opening up for Duke Ellington.
No?
Wow.
His big band.
He played here in Santa Cruz?
Yeah. And he was a music hero of mine. I wrote music and I studied his music and so on. And I had a band of pros. So he invited us all to sit in with him, which was a nice thing.
Oh, yeah.
So we didn't get the check that night. I had to come back, and had to go upstairs in the Del Mar Theater where they had an office and meet the guy, his booking agent. I won't mention his name. He's super famous. And all the people on his roster are who's who in music people. That's how the level the guy was in, you know? So I go up there, He says, okay, kid, here's your check. Now get out of here. I couldn't get down the stairs fast enough. You know, I didn't wisecrack. You know?
Yeah.
I didn't tell him, well, I got a guy that takes care of stuff, you know, if you need some help.
Yeah.
Not Louis, not Luigi, not Guido, no. But the real flexible guy, Linguini.
Linguini.
But I didn't, no, just this guy is like heavy duty mafia running the music industry. I mean, you know what? I mean, I might have been honored at some time in my life if he was the booking agent, because everybody he booked were all famous people there. Part of the legends of music.
Yeah.
Well, was strange, you know?
It is. Well, you know, you have to kiss a ring or two for that particular brotherhood.
I didn't. Okay. I had a different tract.
Exactly. So where did you go with that? I mean, after that, when you left that scene, did you...
I had a band, and we played all over the place, you know, all over California mostly.
Yeah.
You know, and a few... Yeah. And with great players. All of those bands, we could have just gone in the recording studio and recorded. It wasn't like a local pickup band. The musicians I played with were heavy duty pros.
Yeah, so they were the top of their game.
The best.
Wow.
You know.
And so you got to absorb
yeah,
all that.
Yeah, the bass player in that group was Ray Drummond, and he ended up playing with a lot of famous jazz piano players. Mm-hmm. Paul Jackson, he was the bass player with Herbie Hancock's Headhunters.
Yeah.
We had a band that it was called Masters and Jackson, the Groove Therapists.
The Groove Therapists.
Yeah, you're right. And Paul sang, played organ and bass. Yeah. I played piano and trumpet, and we had a drummer, Steve Robertson, and we played a steady gig at the Bayview Hotel in Aptos. Mm. It was an interesting scene there.
The old Bayview, yeah.
Yeah, and it was cooking. They had New Orleans music there. It was a happening.
Oh, cool.
Place for a while, you know?
Yeah, I heard back then there was the Barn in Scotts Valley, but you're saying in Aptos we had the...
That was fantastic gig. And Paul was like one of the top electric bass players. I think he just passed away a few years ago. Yeah. He moved back to Japan to do productions and after the Headhunters. But what a bass player. He is one of the top, along with Jaco Pastorius and a few other people, were the top electric bass players in jazz history and funk.
Wow.
That was fun.
Yeah.
You know.
You stay in touch with some of these folks?
Today? The ones who haven't passed away. Some of them. You know? That's a bummer because I can't call up a lot of the musicians. Hey, let's get to have a little reunion. Let's go back in the studio. They're not here. I mean, they might be on another level.
Yeah. No, if you're picking up a field, maybe they're in that field.
Yeah. I miss some of them. They were great players that played in my bands. Uh-huh. One was the bass player for Frank Sinatra. It was one of the early players, you know.
Do you ever feel like you can bring in some of their spirit in your playing sometimes? Uh-huh. Because you love them or you care about them?
Oh, yeah. I definitely do that.
It brings them into your...
Yeah, because I, growing up and learning to play, I would imitate a lot of musicians. Mm. I put on records and try to play everything that I was listening to. So I could duplicate it and learn how to do that. Hmm. You know, so it's kind of like learning to channel. When I first played guitar, I mean, I had a rock track too, where I had 28 Ventures albums. And I could play most of the songs on their albums. They were one of the great, you know, Walk Don't Run and Apache. And I don't know if you remember the Ventures. Well, they were the most famous instrumental band in the world at that time. And they had... you know, rhythm guitar, lead guitar, bass, and drums, four-piece.
So I have an adventurous question for you here, Randy.
All right.
Is where are we taking all of this into the future? You have taken us from where you started.
The Ventures.
And we're having an incredible trip down memory lane. Yeah. But
30th anniversary for the Ventures. This year.
Yeah. And
oh yeah.
You know, you're a teacher, and you're bringing people in all the time to new levels of understanding of music and harmony and sacred geometry and all kinds of things. And I'm really curious about your view of the role of all of these finer sensibilities that you have in the future.
Well, I see performances. I wrote a paper about it. This guy named Castellanets, I think it was his name, he wrote Theater of Mixed Means. I don't know if you know that book. It's within the film world.
Uh-huh.
And I was into that where the lighting is a certain way. And now I know what frequencies the lighting could be tuned to.
Oh, wow.
You know, and what musical notes go with that. I mean, I've studied that kind of detail.
So you have like a sort of a synesthetic...
Totally.
You can bring lighting that synesthesia. Is harmonic with the music.
Synesthesia. Yeah.
Wow.
Synesthesia.
You think you can trigger off synesthesia with music and sound? And
oh, yeah, when they work. I mean, because a lot of things are isolated.
Huh.
Somebody's jamming with the lights, but they don't really know that. They go by whatever they're feeling.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Yeah.
And they do good stuff, and it's creative, but it's not like they know, here's a song. Like, if you play Mood Indigo by Duke Ellington, can you create indigo lighting?
Wow.
A little bit more subtlety.
Oh, a lot. It could be a lot.
Yeah.
Then you can get into the healing effects of certain colors. Look at all the red light therapy going around in the spas and that type, certain wavelengths of red light. Well, instead of just have red lighting on the stage, like you get almost every stage you ever go to in the lighting, you have certain wavelengths of red light that can help cells.
That heal the band and the audience.
well, exactly. And that type of thing. So I've studied those wavelengths. Hmm. Now, I'd need to be able to have lighting people who would have those wavelengths available in their lighting repertoire.
Yeah, like the
not
infrared,
just red, or not just indigo, or whatever it is, you know?
There's a whole spectrum of lighting frequencies you're aware of that would be good to have?
Yeah, I've studied a whole chromatic scale. Huh. I have light frequencies for everything.
And I'm curious, have you worked with lighting artists who have access to the ability to tune their lights to those frequencies?
Some, but minimum, because a lot of them haven't gone there yet. Healer doctors have.
You're right.
Like Dinshaw Gaudioli, who was a Renaissance man. He was even a police chief in New York at one time. And he has a lighting whole philosophy of what lights shine on what part of the body at what time of day for how long for what ailments. He had all that scoped out.
So remember this full spectrum lighting, Dr. Ott?
John Ott.
John Ott, right. And then that was a big deal in terms of healing back in the 70s.
But this is mostly, it was all full spectrum, like a white type light. Yeah. But warm and without destructive cool colors and blues and things. You know, he had the right, so if people had mood challenges in their life, they could put on one of his John Ott light things and get lighting because they weren't getting it from the sun. For whatever, I mean, these are things that they could put into offices. You have a lot better behavior.
Yeah,
you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, the lighting was. Create irritation. Sure.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, they look at the lighting in the schools. You know, the 48-inch tubes.
Yeah.
For all of that. That gave people headaches.
Yeah.
The wrong part of the spectrum for healthy lighting and for good moods and for happiness and well-being. They didn't have that on purpose.
Mm. Oh, really? You think they were aware of it when they were making the choices? They weren't just guided
not,
by
not
some
the
other
interim
random.
People. Mm-hmm. They didn't know that. That there were choices. Mm-hmm. Well, but you go far enough up the food chain in this level for programming people.
Well, I mean, the educational system was designed to program people to feed the machine, you know, to keep it going, to keep industrialization evolving. Yeah. And you can't blame them for that. That's what was going on a cultural level. But
and I couldn't complain in a lot of places that I worked or existed. They would have sent me in high school to the office.
You know, in trouble for being you.
You were sensitive even then to the lighting.
20 years ahead of time, when you go to the principal, when you're acting up. So I learned how to be quiet when I needed to be, and I think that's why it helped me make it this far.
Flying below the radar, huh?
Yeah. Well, no, you see what happens. Your friends say something, it's very intelligent, and then stuff happens.
Uh-huh.
You know?
Uh-huh.
And so I paid attention. I needed to. It was a survival thing, not like trying to be right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In the period Brandy is discussing, there was a lot of interest in Ali Akbar Khan's School of Music and Sound with Bell, and I wondered what contact Brandy would have with Ali Akbar Khan and, you know, the people affiliated with that school, like Zakir Hussain, who would play here, the Yumi Ashram, and that was just the question.
Well, I got a lot of my Indian music background from Shiv Dayal Bhatish, Ashram Bhatish's father, who played a lot of Indian music, and he was a vocalist In fact, he was such a good vocalist in the Bombay cinema world, a lot of people didn't want him to show up because he was better than all the other singers. He was really incredible. And then he got into logging North and South Indian music and the whole history of all of it, all the ragas, and that fit in with paintings and how the musical laws of the ragas are captured in their paintings. It's like a raga painting. I mean, that's a whole other level of language in visuals. And his father and I were wonderful friends, and I learned a lot and some things from Ashwin and other reading and studies that I did.
Sitar Power, a fusion of rock and Indian music.
Sitar Power is the brainchild of Ashwin Bhatish. Tower Records Pulse in California states that it'll stop you dead in your tracks the first time you hear it. CMJ calls Sitar Power a mind-blowing mix of modern funk, gadgetry, and Eastern classical flavors.
You'll receive songs like the Bombay Boogie, Kasbah Shuffle, Raga Rock, Sith Harmony, India Beat, New Delhi Vice, and Sitar Magic. Hear this fantastic East-West blend. To order by Visa or MasterCard, call 1-800-RAG-MALA. That's 1-800-RAG-MALA.